Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When you want to get a message across in writing, how important is it that the letters look right? Back before personal computers put us all in the printing business, fonts and the typefaces they produce were mostly the domain of professional typesetters. Today, with those magical pull-down menus that let us choose the type for everything from office memos to party invitations to emails to grandma, it's not unusual for us amateurs to be able to identify the numerous fonts or to hold strong opinions about the best and worst designs. All this has fascinated my guest since 1971, when, as an 11-year-old boy, he discovered that the shape of the letters on different album covers was, for him, inextricably tied to the emotions evoked by the music. Author Simon Garfield shares what he has learned since then in his new book, Just My Type, a book about fonts. Simon, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's very nice to be talking to you.
This is one of those subjects that people seem to know is a little bit nerdy and yet somehow find irresistibly interesting. Did it take you a while to become aware that other people shared your interest in fonts?
Well, it's interesting because when I told people, I mean, I've always been interested in fonts, as you said, but when I told people I was writing a book about fonts, I had sort of two reactions. One was either, are you totally mad, and who would be interested in that, and don't you have any other way of spending your time? And then the others were, oh, my God, I can't wait, and I love fonts, and what do you think of Cooper Black or Century or Cambria or whatever it is? So the good news is that I think I've converted, well, hopefully I converted at least a proportion of the people who thought I was mad.
You know, the remarkable thing about them is that when fonts work well, we scarcely notice them. But, boy, the ones that don't work have a way of jumping right out at us.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the In the book, I have a very subjective list of my worst fonts, and the one that leaps out at me now all the time is the London Olympic font. And you know, I see that on my daily journey to libraries and friends, and it doesn't work for me at all. You'll be seeing that a lot come next July.
Yeah, this
I'm still yet to receive any sort of explanation about why they've gone for this incredibly sort of unathletic, very jagged, and to me, extremely ugly font. So that you're right, really. You know, the ones that blend in are the ones that we don't notice. But if you know, if they get things, if they get the design wrong, or it's obviously a very subjective thing, or if they get the R wrong or a loop here, you do notice it. And you often can't explain why. You can see a sign and you kind of think, now, you know, why am I drawn towards that sign? I mean, obviously, it's a great thing. You know, advertisers, in a way, want you to notice, you know, what they've got to say. So they will deliberately pick fonts and type that you will, you know, that will arrest you and also will have associations with other things. But obviously, if we're talking about text and documents and things we read online and things we compose ourselves, as you said, you know, we don't want to be snagged by the type.
I'm always concerned when I'm using different fonts in a document, whether or not they go together. Are there rules that people who pay attention to this sort of thing like to follow in terms of deciding what matches?
No, there aren't really. I mean, if there are any rules, it's don't use too many fonts on any one sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. That's sort of one thing you can say. I mean, I always kind of think no more than two. But there's no kind of chalk and cheese element to it. But obviously, you know, if you're composing a serious piece of work, you don't want the serious bit to be in Times New Times New Roman or Gil Sans or Helvetica, which are all fairly sober, and then have a headline in Comic Sans, which clearly isn't.
Let's talk about Comic Sans for a minute, because this is one of those fonts that, as you explain, first of all, wasn't even meant to be a font in common usage, and you describe it as something that looks like the very neat handwriting of an 11-year-old child.
Yeah, as you say, you know, it was intended not as a typeface, but as a solution to a dilemma as perceived by a man called Vincent Canary. Now, he was working at Microsoft at the time, and this is sort of early 90s, and he saw a new program that was going through the system, a software system that was designed to kind of hold your hand. If you weren't very used to computers and word processing and number crunching, it was going to kind of take you through it. But the real problem, as he saw, was it was in a rather boring, safe typeface, which was Times New Roman. And he basically thought, well, okay, it's a fine typeface, and it's been around for, you know, 80 years or whatever now. But he actually thought, well, why don't we have something a little bit more friendly, especially if it's going to appeal to kind of kids who perhaps haven't used a computer before. So he was a fan of graphic novels, and I think he had the Batman, one of the Dark Knight Returns graphic novels by his desk. And he thought, well, wouldn't it be great if I could sort of, you know, transpose the speech in comics, which was obviously kind of handwritten. Wouldn't it be great if I could do this as a typeface, and it would look very, very friendly, and it would look also as if it had been written individually for you. So he devised this typeface, which came to be known as Comic Sans, and he sent it to his superiors, one of whom was Melinda French, who would later turn out to be Mrs. Bill Gates. And they came back with bad news and said, it's a nice idea, but it simply isn't going to fit our format. But they hung on to it, and they found that it did work in a film system, in a film, sorry, a piece of film software that they had. And then they put it on Word, and when it was on Word, as you might imagine, it went all over the world overnight, and people found that there was a new typeface on their pull-down menu, and they quite liked it. And the people who really liked it were the people who was maybe slightly frightened of typefaces, weren't quite sure what to use, and they thought, well, this is a very friendly face, as it is. And it's fantastic, like all type. It's great when used correctly. So if you're doing an invitation to a kid's party, or if you've got a village fete and you want to, you want to have a nice, accessible, easy-to-read kind of color typeface, it's great. Not so good if you... if you see it on the sides of ambulances or in hospitals often as well. You know, accident and emergency departments tend to have them. It's been seen on gravestones as well. The real lesson to be learned from Comic Sans, and now there is a lot of a lot of internet activity to try and ban Comic Sans. Not that you could obviously do such a thing, but you can buy the banned Comic Sans T-shirts and mugs. And the lesson it teaches us is every type has a correct use.
So I want to get this out of the way right now for the purists among us. What is the difference between a font and a typeface?
Okay, well, it's interesting. There were sort of two commonly used interpretations. I tend to use them interchangeably because that's the way, obviously, my book is, you know, designed as an accessible book, and that's the way people use both font and typeface in common language. So I tend to sort of use them interchangeably, but that's not strictly the way, as you say. You know, if you're a connoisseur, you probably wouldn't do that. So there are two interpretations. Some people use typeface as the name, the particular name of a font. So that might be Helvetica, and then they would use the font, or they would say the font was the form of Helvetica. So it would be Helvetica Bold or Helvetica Condensed or something like that. Other people feel that a typeface is only a typeface when it's drawn by a type designer and drawn on hand. The minute it enters your computer, it then becomes a font. So you can pick and choose between those.
So I'm just going to stick with you and use them interchangeably for this hour. And
well,
we'll just
I'm
have
yet
to have
to
people
be,
forgive us.
I'm yet to be put away for that awful crime. But some people do mind, yeah.
How did Gutenberg settle on the design for his very first crate of movable type?
Well, obviously, he didn't call what he did either a font or a type.
Yeah. Right?
For him, it was just a piece of mechanical work, really. He thought, if I'm going to have something that prints books for the first time in the West with movable type, i.e. type that you can form a block of a Bible, and then when that Bible is printed, you can break up the text and reuse the letters in new words. And he thought, well, what I need is for carvers, he didn't do this himself, mm-hmm. To carve something in metal that resembles books that exist. Because obviously, if you're producing something new, that the war art was crucial for him was the mechanization of it.
Yeah.
What he didn't want to do is print something that people couldn't read. Mm-hmm. So the type that he used, which obviously we now regard, I suppose, as the first typeface, was something that did resemble a book that had written by a scribe. So if you were, if you were wealthy or if you were in the church, all your books prior to Gutenberg would be handwritten and be very elaborate and have elaborate text. And now we regard this as very hard to read. It's a sort of, again, several ways of describing the font. It's Old English, it's Gothic, and it's black letter is the most common one because it does form a very big black impression. And it's a sort of type, and the most common usage now, which sort of has its roots back with Gutenberg in Germany in the 15th century, are the mastheads that we see on classic newspapers. So the New York Times masthead, which I'm sure all your listeners can imagine, is very ornate. You can imagine the T on there. It has lots of sort of crossbars and lots of swirls all over the place. It looks a bit like a portcullis.
Hmm.
And that's sort of the closest that we use sort of Gutenberg's type now. And it's known formally now, his first type, it has been given a name subsequently, and it's known as Textura.
And I gather it took a long time for particular fonts to be standardized so that from one print shop to the next in a different part of the world, there was a sort of standard toolbox to work from.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, what tended to happen is that, types used to be, pre-computers, lithography and sort of, the printing mechanisms that we used to from the 20th century. Typefaces used to be incredibly valuable and precious and closely guarded things. And they weren't easily transportable across borders because they were so heavy. And also, there was great secrecy about them. And the people who carved the letters were in huge demand. Now, you'll have to excuse me, Chris. I'm just going to have a sip of water otherwise.
Absolutely. In fact, we're going to take a quick break right now, so it's a perfect time for you to have a drink. Simon Garfield is my guest. His new book is called Just My Type, a book about fonts. You can join our conversation, maybe ask a question about something you've been wondering about fonts for a long time by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Garfield. His new book is called Just My Type, a book about fonts. You can be part of the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Simon, you were saying that in days of old, these fonts were very closely guarded. They were very precious to the print shops that owned them. Can you tell us a little bit about Dove, which ultimately was so precious that it was dumped into the Thames?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was fantastically precious to the man who invented it. And I tell you what happened. A bizarre tale, really. Quite a local one to me here. So in about 1900, a man called Thomas Cobden Sanderson thought he could make the most beautiful font in the world. And he called this Doves. And it was based on a Venetian font from, I don't know, 1480, 1490 or so. But he sort of, it was modernized a bit and it looked terrific. And the idea was that not only did he have, the reason he wanted a beautiful font was because he thought he could make something he called the book beautiful. Now this was, you know, he was heavily influenced by the arts and crafts movement and William Morris, and the idea was that, you know, you could say something in one way, but if you could say it in a more beautiful way, then it would have an effect on your soul. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the same is true now. So Dove's was a great hit. He made his Dove's Bible. It sold very well. He was not alone in his company, however. He had a friend, or initially a friend, who he then fell out with. And he decided that after he died, he didn't want his friend to use Dove's. And he also didn't want anyone else to use it, just in case it might fall into, it might be used in unscrupulous ways to print things that he didn't approve of. So he had this plan that for 5 months of the year, in, I think, 1906, he would take all the type, and these were heavy, heavy metal blocks, on his back, on his bike, and cycle to the Thames and throw this all off Hammersmith Bridge. And he met with various sort of calamities, all sorts of type, you know, wouldn't, it didn't reach sort of the bottom of the Thames, and it sort of hit the bank, and he thought he would be discovered and everything. And this was all exactly what he did was revealed in his journals after he died. And then his partner was so obviously outraged by this that he tried to sue his weirdo, and she had to relent and I think paid him the sum of £700. In compensation. But as a result, Dove's is one of the few typefaces that you have to get from the original source, and you can't buy it online, and at least not legally. And it's not something that we can use now.
How hard is it to get a font copyrighted?
How hard is it?
Mm-hmm.
It's very tricky because I think that it varies sort of throughout the world, but the general thinking is that you have to register each letter individually, and it's extremely hard to point out how one A is not like another A from, 1530 or 1680 or 1983. So it's a tough one. There is a general sort of good karma amongst type designers. And especially now online, you'd be found out pretty soon if you were plagiarizing someone else's typeface. The other thing to point out, with the exception of many of the types that we have on our pull-down menu, not many types make a huge amount of money. Mm. And there aren't that many people in the world who can exist purely with the profession type designer to their name.
We're so accustomed to having all those typefaces on our pull-down menus, and it used to be just a few, back in the 80s when we had our first computers, and now it's quite a few. But in fact, it wasn't necessarily a given that our word processing programs would give us more than a couple of choices.
Well, yes. I mean, the first computers that we had, the sort of flickering green screens had one, and that was a sort of thing that resembled a sort of dot matrix printout. And then, of course, Steve Jobs, in his wisdom, fell in love with fonts and type. And the reason this came about was he dropped out of college. This was 10 years before the first Mac. He dropped out of college and he found that he could basically attend any classes that he wanted. And he went to a calligraphy course and fell in love with letters and letter forms and how if you wrote something one way, it would look different to if you wrote it another way. So when the first Mac came out in the 80s, we had a choice of fonts, and this was a revelation. As you said at the top of the hour, before we were utterly reliant on professionals, and then, I mean, if we could afford a Mac, but obviously pretty soon, any PC, any computer that we worked on had a list of fonts. So after a while, we all became type gods.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is author Simon Garfield, whose new book is called Just My Type, a book about fonts. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Barbara in Dallas. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm fascinated by fonts, and I always look at the small blurb of information about the book's typeset at the back end of a book, and I was wondering what the history was behind this.
Well, it's interesting. I have a particular bugbear about that, because often now, I think this goes for sort of books in Britain and the States and elsewhere as well. Publishers often don't put the type on their on their book, either at the beginning or the end. And I'm always fascinated by the what type it is. I'm also fascinated by what what type they use on the jacket as well. But it's coming back a little bit, I think. And I think it depends on the designers rather than the publishers. So, it's not as if kind of all Random House books have them and all, HarperCollins books don't. I think it very much depends on, it partly depends, I think, a little bit on the genre of the book. So I think you see it a little bit more in literary fiction, perhaps, than you would do elsewhere, but it's and I think it's coming back as well, because I think people have said, like you, you are really interested in these in typefaces and what they use, and we need to have them there. But there was certainly a period in the 80s and the 90s where that habit died out.
So, Simon, you've written a dozen books. Have you ever felt so much pressure to ensure that the publisher used the ideal font than you did for this book?
Well, obviously, these are discussions we had early on. And what we decided to do was, I think there were more than 200 different fonts in the book. And so we introduce a new font when I first mention that. So if I talk about Cooper Black, for instance, then the first mention would be in Cooper Black. And there is a very long list at the back of the book of all the fonts that we use. The choice of the main text for the bulk of the book, which is a lovely font called Sabon, it was actually not mine. It was the man who designed the book came up with it, and we had three or four choices, and he set pages of the book in various fonts, and Sabon or Sabon, as some people call it, was the one we chose. And it's a fairly traditional font in many ways, and it's a serif font, which means traditionally, I'm sure most of your listeners know, it has those little tips and legs. It's just provides a nice sort of airy, very, very clear read. But it must be said, of course, that if we're talking about books in particular, that the choice of type is one element. And then obviously how much spacing you put between the words and also between the lines is obviously also key.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Edward who wants to know how and why Helvetica has endured the test of time as a font, and is there a new Helvetica on the horizon?
Well, there's more than one Helvetica. In terms of there are, you know, as I kind of said, I mean, I can't possibly tell you all of them, but there is a huge choice, and they range from, you know, Helvetica bold and bold oblique and light and light oblique and regular and many, many more. It's endured, and in fact, it's one of my favorite fonts, even though you see it everywhere. Mm. I mean, it's there was a terrific film made about Helvetica called Helvetica. Which was an hour and a half or so of people talking about why it is everywhere and why it has endured. So if you're particularly interested in Helvetica, I would recommend that film. And in a way, that film was one of the things that inspired me to do the book, because I kind of thought, well, that's a great story, and there must be, you know, 100 other great stories about 100 or 200 other great faces as well. It's endured because it was born in the 1950s, late 1950s, in Switzerland. It's a lovely, clear, bold, and very useful font. They originally saw it very much as a signage font, and it certainly works for that. But it works equally well on, you know, any information and any advertising. And companies have used it, you know, across the board, from BMW to American Apparel to Saab, and a huge amount of companies have used it. And there's a story in the book of a man who tried to spend a day without Helvetica. So he kind of got up in the morning, couldn't read the newspaper because that might contain a bit of Helvetica. He couldn't put on his normal T-shirt because the washing instructions would be in Helvetica, especially if they came from American Apparel, but also kind of elsewhere. He couldn't get the, this was in New York, he couldn't get the subway into town because the subway signs are all in Helvetica. He obviously couldn't put on his computer. He found that he thought he could escape for lunch, but no, even the Chinese restaurant he went to had Helvetica on the menu. So he had a tough time. It is, you know, you see it everywhere. And I saw it yesterday in a new sign warning people of kind of traffic works in the middle of Piccadilly in London, and it works. What I should say is kind of to add to that, it's almost impossible to say why a typeface works so well when it does. It's a bit like saying, well, why does a Beatles song work so well, or why do we love this painting by Miro or Picasso or Rembrandt so much? And you can say, oh, well, I like it because of the subject matter, or I like it because of the colors, or I like it because of the light. But ultimately, it works on you in a much deeper level than that, as does music as well. You know, a great song has a power of penetrating very deeply, and it's the same with type.
You know what's amazing to me is how well a 500-year-old typeface like Garamond still works today.
It's extraordinary. I mean, my website is mostly in there, Garamond, and it is extraordinary. I mean, obviously, you know, things have been modernized slightly, and the Garamond we have today is a Garamond that is, well, it's kind of foolproof because it's obviously been digitized, and it's you know, we can use it in any way, and unlike you know, the original metal letters, it tends not to fall apart or fade or kind of anything else. I mean, it, you know, it's it's a it's a kind of odd thing. People often say, well, why do we need, you know, so many typefaces when, as you say, you know, you've got something like Garamond or Baskerville or Caslon or, you know, any of those that kind of go back through the centuries, and they work perfectly well. And it's really, you know, as I said, with Comic Sans, it's really, the use to which they're put. And if you want something modern and emotional and hip and trendy and something that hasn't been seen before, you need something new. It's you know, I'm answering my own question kind of here with another one. But it is like, why do we need so many songs, or why do we need so many different types of chair? You know, why not just have one type of chair? And it's because we are partly, I think, a creative race, and we like making new things, and we like making new things that fit the time. And we have to be careful, you know, not to reject the old one. So I'm always, you know, fantastically grateful to the people who decided to put the old types on the pull-down menu when, you know, easily the decision could have been made, no, we're only going to have stuff that's been made in the last 30 years.
I thought it was funny that Ariel makes the list of most used types, most visible types, and least favorite types. What's so bad about Ariel?
Well, it's an odd one, really. A lot of type aficionados don't like Ariel because it's seen very much as a Helvetica clone. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also hugely popular, especially in offices and any sort of, you know, if you like, official circles. And, it's a very good, clear type. And types don't survive. They don't get used throughout the world if they're not efficient and clear, and if they don't do a good job, and if they're not legible. But people don't like it because when Microsoft wanted a font that looked a little bit like Helvetica, they picked this, and it serves a very similar purpose. I describe in the book how they're actually, you know, you look at them from afar and you think maybe they are the same, and then you get a little bit closer and you see actually no, the, you know, the C is different and the A and the R are a little bit different.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is author Simon Garfield. We're talking about his new book, Just My Type, a book about fonts. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Garfield. His new book is called Just My Type, a book about fonts. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When you were talking, Simon, about the sort of minor differences between Helvetica and Arial, I was thinking about another section that fascinated me, which is that people who make fonts also spend a lot of time figuring out the very best phrase, often a nonsense phrase, that shows off what it is their font can do. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you're, you know, if you want to sell, I mean, this existed pre-computers as well. If you want to sell a new font, you want to come up with the kind of catchy phrase that will, as you say, you know, to display it to its sort of utmost and show why. You know, it's cool, and you can sort of use the classic one, which is I'm sure your listeners know this. You know, which is the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog, mm-hmm. and that's known as a pangram because it's a way of using all the letters in the alphabet in a short, in the shortest way possible. It's not a perfect pangram because that would be the alphabet in the alphabetical order, and the only thing that does that, obviously, is the alphabet. but they come up with all sorts of phrases. I've got some in the book. There's one which is quick wafting Zephyr's Vex Bold Jim, Sphinx of Black Quartz, Judge My Vow. But then there are some that make a little bit more sense, which is including Zany Eskimo craves fixed job with quilting party, and playing jazz vibe chords quickly excites my wife. But what
is it like? Really bad dating ads.
there's a video on YouTube which actually does show a quick brown fox jumping over a lazy dog. It's an extraordinary thing. The dog does look lazy. The fox is brown, or you know, as far as one can tell from the video, and people are thrilled. They say, "My God, this actually happens in real life." It is grand. And there are all sorts of other sort of ways of displaying type as well. And online, there are all sorts of, you know, I was trying to encourage my friends and hopefully your listeners as well to kind of branch out, you know, and maybe treat yourself to some fonts that aren't in the pull-down menu. And then if you go to the online font suppliers, there's any amount of them, you know, Font Shop and Font Bureau and Adobe and many others as well. And they all did display, you know, their new kind of hot type in a dizzying array of phrases.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sherman on the line in Dallas. Hey, Sherman.
Hi, this is Sherman. How are you doing?
Sherman, hi.
Doing,
great.
Simon?
Hi, very well, thank you.
I was, growing up, I always like making my own letters, you know, writing them on paper and whatnot. And I was wondering, well, you just kind of answered the question on who sells fonts, but who are the font makers nowadays? Who sits around and makes fonts? You said earlier that they really can't make a living out of it, but like, is this a hobbyist on the floor? Is it people that actually sit down and do it?
He kind of broke up there, but he was asking, is this something that hobbyists do, or is this something that professionals are working on?
Well, the answer is both, really. There are, you know, as I said, it's hard to make a living out of just being a type designer, and people tend to do a lot of other kind of graphic design work as well. But there are some people who do nothing but, and I interview a fair amount of them in the book. That this, I kind of the man who I think sort of wears the crown is a man called Matthew Carter, who is a Brit. He now lives in Massachusetts, and he's in his 70s, and he's basically worked in type and with letters in one sense all his life. He began sort of carving metal, and then worked in the earliest form of sort of computer printing and design, and now designs typefaces. And he's a man behind fonts Verdana and Georgia and a huge amounts of others actually on the pull-down menu. He's also responsible for sort of modernizing a huge amount of the world's newspapers and magazines and the way they look. But there's a very hip go-ahead firm in New York called Hoffler Frere Jones, who are the kind of the hippest design company of the moment, and they specialize in new types, and they are the company who are responsible for President Obama's campaign type, which is called Gotham, if I can say it. And Gotham, they invented in 2000, and they received a lot of fame when Obama picked it up and ran with it throughout his campaign. So that's kind of two examples, and there are many more. But hobbyists do it as well, and you can buy some font software, font designing software, and make your own. So I would have a go at that. I would advise you, it's a lot harder than it looks.
I was interested to read that Matthew Carter and presumably others doing the same thing, when they're starting on a new font, they don't start with letter A and go to B and all the way through Z. There are certain letters that they want to go to first to sort of set the tone for themselves.
That's right. I mean, these include H and and G in particular. And what they find is that when they get those right, it does set the tone for what comes after. I mean, people will, you know, there's no rule to this at all. Although what they find, which is interesting, and I mentioned you can buy software and try doing it, but the top people all follow, you know, one basic principle, is that they first design by hand. And whether they're young or old, they kind of find they have to have that kind of muscle sense, they call it, of designing a particular curve on an R or an ampersand or whatever it is. And then once they've got that, or maybe once they've got the first few letters, they can then transfer it to the computer, and that will obviously kind of help them you know, get things absolutely spot on. But it is an artistry. People feel that, oh, you know, it must be easy. And I tell you who do not find it easy is that, you know, almost every design course in the country, a graphic design course, and some fine art courses as well, they encourage students as part of their, you know, early semesters, really, to try and design an alphabet, because it teaches you a lot of things. It teaches you about control of the pen and patience and discipline and the shape of, you know, letters as well. And I know from talking to a lot of students how hard they find it.
It sounds incredibly hard. How big are those initial mock-ups of a letter? Are they a couple of inches high so that they can sort of have enough space to design all the detail they need?
They would be... well, I mean, again, you know, obviously every designer would have their own preference, but they would be slightly larger than you know, a normal thing that one would write oneself, let's say on a, you know, on a card or something. But then we're not talking about colossal letters. We're mm-hmm. talking about things that are very manageable. So yeah, a sort of inch or two, I'd say.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Mike.
I've been a graphic designer and art director for about 30 years. And one of the debates that still goes on after all these years is the use of either sans serif or serif fonts for body copy, whether it be for advertising or marketing literature. And I was wondering if you got into any of that big debate in your book.
Yes, no, I do talk about it. But I come down very much with the conclusion that I talk both in a sort of aesthetic general sense about it, and also a slightly more scientific sense. And there have been all sorts of kind of surveys done about what works best. There were several rules, if you sort of want to use that word, although they're certainly not hard and fast. I mean, one is, you know, following a famous quote from, I think, Beatrice Ward, who was a, you know, well, actually one of the few early important women in type in the 1930s. And she said, you know, one reads best what one reads often. And it's the idea being that if you're used to a serif font, then you will read that best. If you're more used to seeing a sans serif like Helvetica or Gill Sans, then you will read that best. And that's, you know, that's sort of the clarity debate. There is a general impression that in terms of books, a serif, a more traditional serif face with the little legs, tends to ground letters more closely to a page. And that's something that we're used to and we feel reassured by. But it's a mistake, and I'm sure it's not one that you make, but some people kind of think, oh, well, you know, a sans serif font is a very modern font. And it can be made to look modern, but it can also be made to look very old-fashioned. And it's not something that was invented, you know, with Helvetica or something. It's been, you know, sans serif fonts have been around for 200 years or so. So it's sort of, you know, I would say, in a way, it comes down to personal taste. I don't think there are... I think the minute you start imposing, you know, hard and strict rules with type, people are always going to sort of buck against it, and I think quite right, too.
There is a sans serif on the moon.
There is a sans serif on the moon, which is called Futura, mm-hmm. Which the Apollo astronauts left. And Futura is a German font. You would have thought, oh, well, they would have picked something American. But no, it's a German font that they use. It's quite a spiky font, quite acute in a way. Mm-hmm. But you see that all over. Actually, Futura is one of the... there was I like to call a controversy in which I talk about in the book, where IKEA used to have Futura in their shops and in their catalogs. And a couple of years ago, there was outrage when they changed it to Verdana, and people knew something was wrong. People knew something had changed. Huh. I don't know if you have an IKEA store.
A giant one up here, yeah.
Oh, great, okay. You know, people kind of felt a little bit disorientated when they moved around, and then there were all sorts of kind of articles saying, "Oh, yeah, no, we changed our font," and there was especially the real hardcore type nuts were kind of very, very upset by that.
Is there concern that some venerable old fonts will go by the wayside now that we have to make sure that everything is readable, not simply on a computer screen, but on a tiny little Android or iPhone screen?
Well, the choice at the moment on mobile devices is, I think, very, very poor. So, you know, even on the best of these, even on the best smartphones, the choice of fonts is very limited. On the iPad, for instance, you know, which is seen as cutting edge, there's a choice of having under 10 fonts that you can use. I think also on the Kindle, you know, there's, again, the choice is extremely limited. These fonts don't sort of die off. As such, they won't meet the fate of Doves and mm-hmm. end up in the Thames. But I do think that very soon we will be offered more and more. And I think as mobile devices in particular get more sophisticated, they will be able to accommodate most of the types that we can get on normal computers. So, for instance, when you know, there will be a new Kindle before the end of the year, everyone thinks. And I'm sure on that, one of the things that they will introduce, as well as a color screen, they say, I'm sure will be a much wider choice of fonts. So
I'm afraid we have to jump in. We're out of time, Simon. The new book by Simon Garfield is called Just My Type, a book about fonts. Simon, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right, I really enjoyed it, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.